My name is Chris Young, and I'd like to give you a brief introduction to Dr. Richie Shoemaker. Dr. Shoemaker is an MD and a recognized leader in patient care, research, and an education pioneer in the field of biotoxin-related illness. He graduated from Duke University, where he received honors in undergraduate and medical degrees. He is a practicing physician in Pocomoke City, Maryland, and conducts research with collaborators on an international basis. Dr. Shoemaker has dedicated his life and career to uncovering the link between the toxic stew found in many of our buildings and homes and the vast amount of misdiagnosed and catch-all ailments physicians often assign patients for whom they cannot offer any real treatment. By uncovering the real science behind these illnesses and attacking the problem with clinical studies and sound research techniques, Dr. Shoemaker leads the way in not only identifying the true cause of these afflictions, but also in curing those whom the medical community deemed incurable. He truly feels it is imperative for patients to educate themselves and has committed his time and resources to providing them with the tools they need for their survival. His dedication to his patients and his advancement of medicine through research has been recognized often, including receipt of the Maryland Academy of Family Practice Physician of the Year 2000 award, which was followed by an award as a finalist in the national competition for 2002. Dr. Shoemaker is asked to lecture to academic and lay audiences alike, including addresses to the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate. He has published 8 books, the newest being Surviving Mold, and has numerous publications in scientific research journals, on audio, videotapes, and in newspapers. And the story there, the inside story there is, if you're going to read anything about mold, Dr. Shoemaker would highly recommend that you read Surviving Mold. He has made many presentations at scientific meetings and has frequently appeared on television. Look for his upcoming show on mystery diagnosis in 2011. Dr. Shoemaker has was the lead committee member of the July 2010 Policyholders of America position paper called Research Committee Report on the Diagnosis and Treatment of Chronic Inflammatory Response Syndrome Caused by the Exposure to the Interior Environment of Water-Damaged Buildings. This treatise is widely noted to be the most thorough, rigorous, and transparent of all the discussions of illness from WDB. Dr. Shoemaker's lectures are known for their enthusiastic presentation of thought-provoking ideas. Whether his speech is educational or motivational, he is an entertaining speaker with a stimulating approach to thinking that will challenge the listener, and I bet that is true. Dr. Shoemaker.
Well, good morning. After that introduction, I'd like to meet this guy. I want to thank Dr. Sid Baker for extending an invitation to me to come participate with this group. I got to tell you that just walking around and seeing who had name tags and lanyards on and all this was quite a different experience for me yesterday compared to some of the talks that I normally get to give to audiences where people have stone faces and I think they might have a knife in their back pocket either for your back or for your wallet. But you guys, as I don't think I met everybody here, but I've seen smiles and open faces and genuine caring. So it's a real privilege and an honor indeed, and thank you for asking me to come talk to you about my passions. 2 weeks ago in Boston, I gave 12 hours of lecture. I only get an hour and a half today. Oh my, yeah, I can't do that. I want to tell you about indoor environmental conditions that make people sick. I want to tell you what it is about their illness that you can recognize, and I want to tell you that you don't have to guess. And I may annoy some of you, and probably a lot of you, by saying stop guessing. We have access to the data that you need, These are incredibly complex illnesses. They're incredibly common. And even if the initiating event that made someone sick is not exposure to water-damaged building, according to a paper released by NIOSH January 2nd, 2011, 50% of U.S. buildings are moldy. Now, I was delighted that Eric Gordon and Neil Nathan did not take me to a moldy restaurant last night, but it was all rainy outside, it was nice and dry inside, and with Wayne Anderson, we had some good food that didn't bother me, and that was good. But quite frankly, that is not going to be something that you're going to find all the time. And whether you're in rainy Seattle, of course it's supposed to be nice today, or in dry Sedona, indoor environments can be water damaged from any number of places. One fellow is going to move to New Mexico and says, well, I'll be all right there. I said, sure hope you don't have indoor plumbing. So we're going to talk about the academic basis of treatment. A barrier that is real for me trying to talk to new people is language. I have a ton of jargon. Sid has politely suggested that I not be like Niagara Falls, dumping information at a mile a minute on you, and I'll try to keep up to that proscription of too much data. But the jargon that I have is all in peer-reviewed literature. It's not something I've made up. The jargon that I use is the illness of your patients. And so in this perhaps overdone introduction, I do believe in this idea of empowerment, which is to teach patients what's wrong with them, because it's not just fixing the initial illness that leads to surviving mold. It is recognition and avoidance of subsequent exposures and what to do based on knowing the jargon. I don't think I have any disclosures other than the fact that I've written books in the field and have a website, so those are those disclosures. When we talk about an approach to the patient, to me that's the basic fundamental concept in medicine. How do you approach someone new that comes walking your door, says, doctor, I'm tired? I would hope that you would look to evidence-based medicine and not be too dissuaded by that jargon term itself. Essentially, evidence-based medicine means that you are going to evaluate the patient and come up with a differential diagnosis, and for that, you're going to look to peer-reviewed and published literature as well as thoughts and discussions from others that might not have been peer-reviewed to then sort out what makes sense and what doesn't and then go back to the patient again. So evidence-based medicine is something I get to hear a lot about in courts and legal testimony as if this were some sort of sanctuary of those in tertiary institutions and those that don't fight battles. I fight a lot of battles. I would request that your analysis of the patient be rigorous. I request to be thorough and I request to be transparent. One of the biggest problems that I see are guesses. There is no room for assumptions here. I'll just remind you that in 2006, there was a request from Senator Kennedy's Health, Education, and Labor Committee to send to the General Accountability Office to review the government evaluations of mold and water-damaged buildings, and the GAO came up with a statement in September of 2008, followed by the World Health Organization in July of 2009, and then the POA, Policyholders of America, statements in 2010 that have pretty much destroyed the empty-headed ideas that we had from ACOM and 4AI and American College of Medical Toxicology about what goes on with mold illness. So if you're involved in this field and you want to have academic literature that's already been done, those three publications are available to you on survivingmold.com. I encourage you to read through them. Essentially, what we're looking at is an academic basis of this problem that's written by people who have not sold out to insurance companies. So what's damp buildings? What are damp buildings? Damp buildings are those that had water intrusion that has not been dried out adequately in 2 days. Sounds kind of simple, but within 2 days, if you leave the rug in your basement after the water heater broke, or whether the condensation pan of the HVAC unit started leaking into your bathroom, if you leave things intact that can hold moisture and become a reservoir for microbes, then you walk into the trap of saying, am I going to be ill from exposure? Even though we talk about mold, and you're going to hear silly words like black mold and toxic mold, please don't use those. It just shows lack of knowledge of what's going on. What we have is an ecosystem with inside a water-damaged building that's fairly unique. Here we have an environment that basically is 65 to 72 degrees year-round. It's not a pile of leaves outside or a compost pit that has fluctuations in temperature and sunlight has all these additions and then rain and all this. This is a very different kind of environment. And remember, fungi are digesters, and they will send enzymes across their fortresses of cell walls to take complex molecules in the environment and break them down. Those complex molecules, when broken down, provide free food for any number of organisms that say thank you very much. And we kind of wonder, why do fungi make antibiotics? Well, they're trying to kill bacteria. They're trying to take their amino acids and their sugars and their fatty acids. But in the complex environment of a compost pit, there's way more than just what a little antibiotic can do. So that what you have indoors is very different in that drywall and rugs and subflooring and cellulose-contained air conditioning and heating ducts are not the sign of substrate that you think about with rotting wood chips and leaves. It's nice to be able to look at organisms in water-damaged buildings and speciate them. We can talk about fungi. We can talk about bacteria, primarily gram-negative rods. We can talk about mycobacteria and actinomycetes. But sometimes we don't have that option. And what we're going to look at is evidence of microbial growth. And don't forget that soot around some of these vents will look just like mold. Don't guess. Do some sort of test. A tape lift will cost you $35, give you an idea whether it's soot or something else. We're going to tell you more about moldy environments, but don't forget, just musty smells. Geosmin, by the way, made by actinomycetes, is the source of that musty smell, is enough to tell you you've got microbial amplification with that environment. And I mentioned that I prefer that you look at the sources of inflammation found inside water-damaged buildings. Yes, toxins are an important part of my life, and endotoxins and mycotoxins are things you hear about, but don't forget inflammagens. You hear about volatile organic compounds or VOCs made by microbes or MVOCs. Way more important are beta-glucans and structural elements of cell walls called mannans. Compounds that fungi and bacteria make called hemolysins and proteinases are all part of the mixture. We know that some of the glycoproteins or sugar-containing proteins found in these environments are detected by mannose receptors and have their own category of really bad inflammatory issues that we worry about. But I want to just tell you that the source of problems inside water-damaged building are not great big structures like spores. Spores can be 3 to 8 microns, and in microbial world, that's huge. We're looking at fragments of spores. We're looking at fragments of conidia, part of the fruiting bodies of fungi. We're looking at teeny tiny things that, as a general rule, are enriched in an environment that's 0.45 to 0.60 microns in size. So when you talk about treatment, and we're going to get to that in a bit, what I want you to know is removal of the 0.45 to 0.6 micron size material are far more important than spores. Now, having said that, spore counting by itself as indication of potential for human illness is silly. But I still see it. Nice work done by NIOSH and some others have shown that for every molecule of a toxin found on a spore, there'll be 500 molecules found on fragments. So when you spore count, you're looking at 0.2% of the total problem. Not a real good idea. The other thing that kind of kills me, if you ever sat alongside of a stream as a kid, or maybe as an overgrown kid like me, and you throw a leaf or something into the stream and watch it go downstream, if you throw that bit of flotsam, Yeah, that's right. Into the water current, the leaf will be pulled down quickly if it's in the middle of a current, but not if it's in the boundary layer, not if it's on the outside. So when someone comes to sample inside of a room and plops up an air sampler in the middle of the room, they might open the window, they might open the door, might have people coming in and out. They're trying to be a little fraudulent, they're guaranteed to open the window a long time before. But what are they measuring? You're measuring 5 minutes of what was in the air in the middle of a stream. Why don't you go where things are going to be deposited? Why don't you go to the side of the stream? I had the pleasure of listening to the last little bit of Neil Nathan's talk last night. And yeah, I came in just he's talking about visual contrast, so I'm going to focus on that a little bit. But, you know, at dinner we're trying to say, if you had one test that you could do that would help you besides visual contrast and in water damage building evaluation, what would it be? In 2006, Steve Vesper and his microbial exposure group from the EPA in Cincinnati published what was called then the EPA Relative Mold Index. It's now been licensed as the Environmental Mold Index. Essentially, Steve had primers for 134 different species of fungi, and they looked at dust inside buildings. Some were water damage that were known, some were not water damage that were known, and they said, what microbes do we have here? Are there differences? And yes, there were. He divided that into two groups, distilling down to 26 of group one and 10 of group two. The group twos are primarily outdoor fungi, the group ones are indoor fungi, and then he did some math that people have argued about to take the sum of the logs of group one, subtract from that the sum of the logs of group two, and get a number. And that number is a building index. And there's some problems with ERMI, but for $300, what a physician can have access to are environmental data that makes sense. You can look at fungal DNA, and you can actually look to see, are these DNA numbers correlated with human health? And we're going to get to that in just a sec, where you see that yes. But specifically, for those getting started with ERMI testing, you're going to say, well, geez, there's 12 different species of Aspergillus in group one. How do I know which ones to look at? And what our group has done in over 1,000 of these assays is separate out which five Aspergillus species are telling us about areas of water saturation that are dried out a little bit, so about 80 to 90% saturation of water, versus the wet conditions of near 100% saturation, that being Ketomium and Stachybotrys, and then Trichoderma and Wallemia are looking in more at dry, wet conditions. And if you think of someone dropping a water balloon onto a deck, there's going to be the splash and the impact, and most of the water will be in the center with less water in a ring around the outside and less water in the ring around that. And that image is one I want you to keep in mind for wet conditions, medium wet conditions, and dry wet conditions. The dry wet conditions are ones most people overlook. This is your heating ducts. This is your HVAC. Remaining HVAC is a universal distributor of what might be bad in your crawl space, gets into your living room, and it's everywhere. So the heating ducts that are sheet metal or galvanized material aren't much of a food source, but those that are made out of cellulose-based material are huge food sources. Incredible. Fungi like it, especially Trichoderma and Wallemia. And again, there was some criticism of ERMI, and I don't think it makes too much difference to go through criticism of ERMI. I'll just tell you that there are a number of labs that sell ERMI. I've looked at a bunch, and while I have no financial interest in mycometrics.com, Dr. Kinte Lin has graduated from his training in mycology at P&K Microbiology in Cherry Hill, and Dr. Lin has given spectacular assistance to my patients. He'll talk to the patients and help them at no charge. If you don't have access to a vacuum cleaner, and you would normally put a little cassette in a vacuum cleaner and vacuum an area 3 feet by 6 feet for 5 minutes, the cassette collects the dust, you take one out, put another one in, go to a different area of the home, typically it's the living room and the bedroom, send those off to Dr. Lin, he'll tell you what you find. But if you have to go into your workplace and you don't have a vacuum cleaner and there's some trouble, you might want to take a cloth, a Swiffer cloth, and just collect dust from the top of the door frame or around window frames that on top of a shelf, for example, that might not be vacuumed by maintenance, and you'll get the same dust collection that gives you the history of what fungal organisms have been in a room. Now remember, ERMI is only giving you fungi. It's not giving you actinomycetes. It's not giving you gram negatives, so it is not whole in itself. I'm going to go into a little more detail about the human health index in just in a few more slides after this one, but I want to let you know that when we think about the question, do we have evidence that people are sickened by water-damaged buildings? Yes, the GAO has given us causality. If you want to look at peer-reviewed literature on water-damaged buildings from 14 countries and 50,000 patients, it's there. The real issue in causation is prospective acquisition of illness. This demands a re-exposure protocol. So if you take someone who's sick and you want to prove that their workplace makes them sick, do you just put them back into the workplace or do you fix them first? Yeah. And then you stop all medications, prove that he's not made sick by his home or his church or his car or the swamp next door. 3 days is all it needs. And then you put him back in the environment, and after day one you check labs, and day two you check labs, and day three you check labs, and in 3 days you'll reproduce 95% of the illness. That short-term prospective acquisition that controls for all confounders wins lawsuits, but it also means that you better be ready to fix the patient a second time when they get sick a second time. And as we circle around countlessly in this talk, we're getting to treatment, and I want you to keep in mind that this idea of prospective acquisition is going on every time someone goes to work in a water-damaged building. And the fact that you're not monitoring and you're not taking care of the observation doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And if a person had Lyme disease with a chronic fatigue, or they didn't get their Trichuris dose for breakfast this morning, although I think I did. What were those little squiggly things anyway? Oh, it was Neil's plate. Well, you were not eating fast enough and you turned your head. And coughed too. But the issue is that independent of what started you, what happens next when you get re-exposed? And Eric was working with me and Neil and his group on doing a study on VIP, and they frankly said, we have so much trouble finding homes in Northern California with ERMIs less than two. I said, well, come on, man. What are you dealing with? And we had that argument too. So I'm trying to think what I should call my health index. And someone told me about sayonara back then. So I thought, that's a good word for health index. So it's sequential activation of innate immune elements with no associated re-exposure activities. Or SIA, to hide the joke from somebody else. But the issue is that if you take the sequence of events that happens to people with exposure into your environments, there's going to be hyperacute responses from preformed elements of innate immunity, complement and cytokines primarily. There is going to be the effect of this cytokine storm on receptors such as leptin, we'll talk about in a minute, in the hypothalamus, so that leptin won't work anymore. There's going to be initiation of differential gene activity, differential gene transcription, and then there's going to be the effects of that gene transcription as making a promolecule that's then split into an active molecule. So we can look at the time course of what's going on physiologically over 3 days. And we know that, and we can use that, and we've done psi in literally a couple thousand patients. So we can go forward and say, here's how you do this. When we look at the five elements of psi, which is symptoms, C4A, VEGF, MMP9, and leptin, what we assign are point values to each one of the changes in these according to the time of acquisition, symptoms more on day three, C4A on day one, and we weight those 5 points for 100% of illness at baseline. We then start adding up what happens when we re-expose patients to control buildings that have ERMIs less than two. Well, their psi is 6.3. We look at remediated buildings, And honest to God, I used to say that remediation was just a short way of saying failed remediation. Oh, Lord have mercy. People do stupid things remediating buildings, and they charge an awful lot of money for it. And being compulsive and helping people get their buildings repaired properly is a real good idea. And you can use SIA to say, was remediation successful? And if the remediation comes back with a SIA over 15, the building's not fixed yet. Might be fixed for someone who doesn't get sick from mold, but it certainly is not fixed for the individual. We know full well that the mean SIA for those buildings that are water damaged without remediation is very different than control values. 17.9 versus 6.3 looks significant, and statistically, I think it's a P is less than 0.0, and there's about 20 more zeros than a 1. So the number is pretty impressive. Now, I'm going to tell you about melanocyte-stimulating hormone. I know Neil presented some of that in the biotoxin pathway for you. MSH and VIP are jargon terms. MSH and VIP are neuropeptides that regulate endogenous or innate immunity. And so if you don't measure MSH, I ask you to do so. Levels less than 35 are very significant. LabCorp will do that to you. Of course, they're going to give you a bogus normal range. And we can go through why that happened, but any MSH that's less than 35 will create the potential for an illness if they go, that person goes in a building with an ERMI greater than 2. I'm going to talk about C4A in just a minute in some detail, but specifically this split product of complement activation, normals are less than 2,800, mean for sick people is about 10,000. When people start getting autoactivation and autoproduction of C4A, these levels will go over 20,000. And when you get into this sicker, quicker range, as I call it, with these elevated levels of C4A, the safety net for moldy buildings falls. And now your ERMI's got to be -1. And the real issue is that you must have no other re-exposure activity. What's a guy going to do if his home's moldy because the crawl space is sitting there with humid air coming in summertime because the vents are open, and you get condensation on a piece of plastic thrown on some soil, and you say, well, that's good. No, it's not. And then there's some pipes running through the crawl space into the upstairs, and there's some flexible duct work in the crawl space, and the duct work is sagged, and air gets sucked into the duct work when you turn on the HVAC. So now you're distributing microbes from a water-damaged crawl space in all your home. And then you go to work, and your work is a place in, say, it's a Smithsonian castle. Oh, you didn't think that's water damaged? It is. You got two places. And where's a guy going to find a place to be safe? Where's the safe place to be if you're one of these common individuals? 98% of those with chronic fatigue have low MSH. All right. When I talk about genetic susceptibility, I'm only referring to the concept of relative risk. And relative risk comes from the epidemiologic idea to divide incidence of a given parameter in cases by the same incidence in controls. If we look at part of HLA, these are immune response genes found on chromosome 6, and we look at HLA-DR and analyze that by PCR, not by serology, we can identify a genetic factor that stands out like a sore thumb, that those that get sick have a given susceptible HLA kind or haplotype, and I might call it genotype if I get pushed. But HLA-DR doesn't change. You get a copy from mom and a copy from dad, and your kid will get one copy from you. Specifically, there are 6 of 54 that are associated with relative risk greater than 2.0. You're going to see these genetic linkages and associations talked about of susceptibility factors. I know the CDC put out some SNPs with the relative risk for chronic fatigue at 1.5. That's crazy. That's not near rigorous enough. 2.0 minimum. And most of these go a lot higher. The inflammatory compounds you need to know about, whether I tell you once, twice, or three times a day about C4A, and then transforming growth factor beta 1, These are ones that you really have to know. They are making your patients sick. And if you don't correct C4A, and if you don't correct TGF-beta-1, you will not correct your patient. You can give them all the whipworm eggs you want. If you don't fix TGF-beta-1, it ain't going to get better. Now, some might say whipworm eggs will fix TGF-beta-1. I want to see the data. He's smiling. MSH and VIP are regulatory neuropeptides. Oh, how I love VIP. I'm having such a good time playing with it because it's like the diabetic who doesn't make insulin. His life's not very good. He's got a systemic illness. He'll die. How about the chronic fatiguer without VIP? Lack of regulation of inflammation, lack of regulation of hormones, lack of regulation of constant things, not just pulmonary artery pressure. What happens when you give him VIP? Holy cow, do good things happen. So the word from Pocomoke is y'all learn about VIP today. Visual contrast is your best friend. Honest to Dickens is portable, reproducibly reliable, non-expensive. It's hard to screw up. You know, and as you do 10,000 of these, hell, 12,000 now, like I have, you'll find out that you can pick out the people that are lying to you, and believe it, there are patients that lie. You'll find out people that are coming to you with secondary gain in mind, especially if you're the expert in court testimony. Don't forget that. But you also have a tool that'll tell you hyperacutely of your effective treatment. Show me a Lyme patient with their Herxheimer reaction. I want to know what's happening in row E of visual contrast. If it's truly intensification, row E falls and MMP9 goes up. Don't guess. Don't tell me it's intensification or Herxheimer. Show me the data. You can do that. Matrix metalloproteinase 9 is an enzyme that is the delivery boy. It delivers inflammatory elements out of blood, puts them into nerve, muscle, brain, joint, and lung. Oh, my goodness, is this guy a bad player? And if you want to look at the inflammatory basis of atherosclerosis, look at how MMP9 teams up with PI1 to deliver oxidized LDL out of blood vessels across two membranes and a basement membrane into the subintimal space. Knock out the delivery boys, you knock out delivery of oxidized LDL. VEGF is vascular endothelial growth factor. There's some very sophisticated mechanisms our body has to detect low oxygen in tissue beds. And what happens with low oxygen is that hypoxia-inducible factor turns on a string of genes, including one that makes VEGF. Vascular endothelial growth factor will stimulate production of new blood vessels, but also increase oxygen and nutrient delivery and capillary flow. It's fascinating, going back to now cancer for a minute, at the anti-angiogenesis movement. Perhaps you read the book by Jonah Folkman about his work looking at blockade of VEGF in his lab at Children's in Boston. It's almost like Alexander Fleming with penicillin. Somebody left a petri dish with a bunch of endothelial cells open. And these endothelial cells are just moving like crazy in the petri dish. Comes back the next day and looks at them. They're all ruffled. They're stopped. Huh? What stopped them? What was it? And there sitting in the petri dish is a colony of Aspergillus fumigatus. And Aspergillus fumigatus was making fumagillin. And fumagillin was the first anti-angiogenic agent used in treatment of cancer. You will find Aspergillus fumigatus as one of your type 1 organisms of ERMI. You will find that low VEGF is incredibly common in cases compared to controls. And restoration of low VEGF correction is one of the elements that we've got to do. And then someone says, well, these mycotoxins are all carcinogenic. Sure they are. But what's the incidence of cancer in my 10,000 mold patients compared to controls? It's less. Less. We're actually putting people in an anti-angiogenic environment and saying, how come we have less breast cancer and less lung cancer? Match for cigarettes. How come we have less colon cancer? Don't know, but I think it's fascinating. Von Willebrand's factor. Boy, I tell you, I did not remember ristocetin-associated cofactor after being out of medical school for a few years. And boy, is it one of the big ones to know about von Willebrand's antigen. And when you start looking at coagulation disorders and bleeding and nosebleeds and hemoptysis, you'll see them at a given time of re-exposure protocols look for deficiency of factor VIII, deficiency of risdiocin-associated cofactor, and then the effect of high C4a on polymerization of multimers of von Willebrand's antigen. C4a blocks that, people hemorrhage. The latest passion is regulatory T cells. Regulatory T cells are knocked down by coagulase-negative staphs, staphs growing on foreign bodies. Low Tregs are found in post-Lyme syndrome. They're found in multiple sclerosis before it's treated. They're found in countless illnesses, including just about all these chronic fatiguing ones that I have. If you want to know if there's a problem with regulation of inflammation from a cellular basis, not a humoral basis with these compounds I'm telling you about, look for Treg cells. If you don't look for Treg cells, you're going to miss patients, and I'm not embarrassed to tell you, I didn't know to look until November of 2010. So I'm giving you, hopefully, some benefit of the last 6 months of finding out how I've been blind to a tremendous contributor to these inflammatory disorders. All right, well, let's just look in. This is a paper that was published in 2009. It was, I think, 812 patients and 160 controls. Let's look at people shown to be ill with exposure to water-damaged buildings who were treated. At baseline, symptoms are statistically different than controls, and so is VIP. Normal VIP should be over 21. MSH should be over 35. MMP9 should be under 332. You should not find cardiolipin antibodies, primarily the IgM class, in these patients, and you do. I know that a lot of people here know more about gluten than I ever will. All I do is measure the antibodies to gliadin. If they're positive, we send off a TTG IgA, hopefully making sure they're not celiac disease. But in adults, positive gliadin antibodies, usually of IgG class, are very common. I use blood. I don't use anything else. And specifically, these are not due to celiac. They're due to low MSH. They're due to Treg cells that are elevated. TGF-beta-1 is sky high, should be 2,300 or less. TC4A should be 2,800 or less. So when I say to you, don't guess, these tests really do sort out tremendously who's the case and who isn't. And the question came up, well, I don't have access to the $600 of testing for these labs, and you might not. But when you start looking at these cases, controls do not have more than four of these parameters, and cases do not have fewer than four. It is almost like a dividing line written on the forehead. Now, how about labs that you might get? Because if you're not going to get my labs because of cost constraints, I'm going to tell you not to get your labs. Unless you want to do differential diagnosis to say what they don't have. Because your blood counts and SED rates and C-reactive proteins, thyroid studies and cortisol and testosterone, they're going to be normal. Lipids, nah. C3 and C4, I can't tell you how many times we've sent out orders for split products of complement activation, C3A and C4A. And the lab tech can read English, knows more than I do, and orders a C3 and a C4. Ay, ay, ay. It's not allergy. Okay, I've mentioned to you a little bit about SIA. You need a lot of informed consent. You need to have your baseline analysis done, and that's probably what I've been telling you about. And now we're going to treat somebody. We'll go through treatment steps. We're going to circle around the back a bit later. I'm not neglecting treatment today. Specifically, what we want to know is, can we prove causation in an illness? So you take someone who's ill, you fix them, reduce symptoms to controls, fix visual contrast, back to normal, correct labs. You stop medication for 3 days. Usually what we do is we draw blood to show how well the guy's done on Friday. Did we fix things? You stop medication over the weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You draw blood Monday morning. Put him back in the workplace for 8 hours on Monday. Draw blood Tuesday morning before he goes to work. Tuesday morning's blood tells you about day one activity. We then keep him off medications. Back to the workplace he goes. On Tuesday, we draw blood Wednesday. Wednesday tells us about day two of activity. Then we put them back to work on Wednesday, draw their blood on Thursday morning, which tells us about what happened on day three. Then we treat them. Because by the time day three gets along, they're sick. And you have the right and the duty as a physician to stop the trial if the patient is too affected. You know, when people are looking at litigation regarding their job or litigation regarding their home, often that's times that's their biggest financial investment. And this is not minor. Doctor, I'm homeless without a job. I can't get disability because someone said I wasn't sick. And your job then is to take up the cudgel and knock the dickens out of those that say there's nothing wrong. C4A, we look at on day one, it goes up. It takes about 10 minutes of exposure to start seeing a rise in C4A. Usually it's an hour of exposure, and we measure that 4 hours later. I love to torture physicians' offices that are moldy. Patients go in, they get sick from their doctor's office, and you say, just go in there and sit in their waiting room. They're going to be an hour late anyhow. Not you guys. And draw the blood 4 hours later. Then you say, doctor, you care for me so much, your office made me sick. And if you haven't done ERMEs on your own offices, and I bet you haven't, you ought to think about that. Because if you've got a moldy building and you're making people wait in the waiting room for an hour, you're assaulting them. You're going to look at day two for leptin, day three for MMP9. VEGF rises very quickly with capillary hypoperfusion from cytokine responses. And that will go up on day one. TGF-beta-1 starts going up on day one, which down-regulates VEGF. VEGF will fall. So this biphasic response, high VEGF, falling on day three, is one of the ones you do. Symptoms we look at day three. All right, we talked about some of these entities. It's fascinating to see measurements of CD4, CD25, Treg cells are following the exact same pattern. We can tell you in a day by falling levels of CD4, CD25, if you've been in a moldy building. A day. We had a discussion with the immunologist from Eric's office, and she didn't agree, didn't think those things changed that quick. And tactful me just said, where's your data? What we're looking at with SIA are innate immune responses. That's where this illness is. That's where it lives. Hyperacute changes, gene activation. And the gene activation, by the way, we can use because we now have assays called genomics assays to look at, of the 40,000 genes, there are 500 involved with inflammation that we can detect with microRNA assays and mRNA assays and nanostring assays. We can actually do one tube of blood and tell you what genes are active in your body at a given time. And that ability to detect differential gene activation is a giant tool. And I'll just tell you that if anyone is interested in having a free genomic analysis done, let me know. If you send us two control patients, we'll give you a free genomic assay. How about that for a deal? And why are we doing that? Because we don't have enough controls from the West Coast. That's why. We got controls from Charleston, South Carolina, and from Pocomoke, Maryland. And the genomics is just incredible. All right. The organisms that I work with are old guys. Blue-green algae, fungi, dinoflagellates, spirochetes, AP complexans. They've been here for 1 to 3 billion years. You know, the idea is that the blue-green algae were the first creatures on Earth that could live in an aerobic environment and release oxygen. The rest of us came along. How did these guys deal with each other? What were their immune responses? It was all innate immunity. And we start looking at this higher evolution of 500 million years ago when we started having immunoglobulins and T-cell receptors and all the things that we think are important. That was on top of innate immunity. Innate immunity came first. Acquired immunity came later. Plants have the same innate immune responses. This is incredible. I mean, how did the first guy, this little blue-green algae, figure out to set up his own innate immune response system? And this preacher told me it came from an asteroid or somewhere else. But this system has stayed with us. And complement and cytokines, It's almost like we're talking brand new language from elements that are billions of years old. And disorders of billion-year immunologic systems, I get told in court, is novel. That's not true. All right, when I talk about antigen presentation, the function of receptors, pattern receptors, is to detect different signposts, different markers that says, I'm not you. They had a baseball game on the other night, and the Boston Red Sox were playing the Yanks, and Boston saying Yankees suck, and the Yankees guys were saying Red Sox suck. I mean, those are antigens, right? They're telling you which team they're on. Yanks won. Boo. At any rate, antigen recognition is accomplished by a distinct pattern of systems, and beginning in about 2000, when a guy from Germany found the first toll receptors and he yelled Eureka in German, which is toll. By the way, I was in Copenhagen giving a talk last year, and there was a Eureka vacuum cleaner in the motel room or hotel room, and it said toll right on it. I thought it was funny. But anyway, antigen presentation begins with antigen recognition or antigen detection that then sends a signal to professional antigen presenting cells that are immature. Antigen detection releases cytokines and complement that matures the antigen presenting cells, which then have little processes of their own receptors that get stuck out into the external milieu, and this binding of antigen to a particular dendritic cell, that's the jargon, not dendrite, that's a nerve, dendritic cell, that complex is engulfed, sucked in, phagocytosis. Wonderful innate immune mechanism, phagocytosis. And here you've got this bubble now inside a dendritic cell that's got an antigen and a receptor, and it sits there as a bubble until that bubble is acidified. You got to pump hydrogen ion into there. Now, some of the biotoxins I work with, called monensin and digerosin and polycyclic ethers from dinoflagellates, prevent acidification. They block that bubble from being released. But if the bubble is acidified, it'll fuse with a lysosome. So we got a phagosome and then a phagoendosome, a phagoendolysosome, that's not in a crossword puzzle, that fuses with endoplasmic reticulum, and now you get an HLA molecule whipped onto this developing complex. And I don't know what happens as you go past the Golgi body, something. And this complex is now extruded onto the cell surface as the dendritic cell migrates to the draining lymph nodes. And there, if there's not a cytotoxic T lymphocyte antibody 4 present, you'll have linkages with this tasty morsel of developing presented complex to a T cell. And if you don't have butyrophilins, that's a new word, found out about that last week. If you don't have butyrophilins, you'll have linkage of this naive T cell to a B cell, and B cell is going to make an antibody. Boy, look at all the ways this antigen presentation can screw up. And how is it we have antibodies made so often? What if HLA is of the wrong kind? Is there going to be something going on? What if there's too much IL-10 present that'll take HLA off of the cell surface? And it does. Cell surface of a macrophage, monocyte, and dendritic cell. How is that T cell going to recognize this dendritic cell or the macrophage or monocyte without its homing station? That's not immune suppressive IL-10. That's immune paralytic. Who does worse than sepsis, by the way? High IL-10. Absolutely. Absolutely. just make sure I don't skip something important. If you are challenged by an insurance company because you're billing for a test, the codes, ICD-9 codes for this kind of illness, which is a chronic systemic inflammatory response, are 995.93, or the hazardous effect of exposure to mold, which is a V code, V87.31. You'll get challenged on those in court. So I'm trying to get across to you bit by bit, understanding I'm leaving things out and skimming some things over, of what a chronic inflammatory response syndrome is. You're going to have defective antigen presentation. You're going to have genetic susceptibility. You're going to have deficiency of regulatory neuropeptides. You're going to have lack of regulation of inflammatory molecules as manifested by elevated TGF-beta-1, C4a, or MMP-9. If MSH is deficient, you're going to have downstream effects on countless hormones. Honest to Dickens, it drives me nuts when I talk to the endocrinologists of the world that ignore MSH, and a lot of them do, because MSH has direct effects on pituitary functioning, particularly ACTH, gonadotropins, and antidiuretic hormone. And to assess any condition or to use replacement compounds along that way without assessing MSH, I think is doing a disservice of major proportions to patients. We know that with capillary hypoperfusion, you're going to be able to use tests like visual contrast that picks up capillary hypoperfusion, and you're going to have tissue hypoxia. We can measure tissue hypoxia with a pulmonary stress test and with magnetic resonance spectroscopy, where we can measure lactate. So you can measure these things. You don't have to guess. And now the critical information of looking at Treg cells. TGF-beta-1 is a biphasic compound. It's released by essentially every cell in the body. It affects just about every cell in the body. And rising levels of TGF-beta-1 should turn on Treg cells to suppress inflammation. That's a nice negative feedback loop, right? And specifically, what happens in inflamed tissue, here's pituitary fillings that I'll tell you sometime about when I know more, actually splitting off elements of these Treg cells, creating in tissue pathogenic T cells. Pathogenic T cells make more TGF-beta-1. So we have this corruption of what should be a regulatory down-regulating system that turns into a pro-inflammatory, tissue-based, or cellular-based immune attack. Now, wouldn't it be nice to block TGF-beta-1 and use drugs like VIP that'll drive up drive up Treg cells? Yeah, it is nice. And let me just tell you, it works. And when you normalize pathogenic T cells in tissue that are still putative, and you fix the genomics that's driving all this thing, what you've got is a happy patient. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about multiply antibiotic-resistant coag-neg staphs. The staphs that, you know, back in medical school in my days were just skin contaminants, and they're present in the nose, and they're resistant to nothing, and forget about them. You get them in a blood culture, you did it wrong. Back in the mid-80s, we started seeing colonization of heart valves and colonization of prosthetic joints with these Marcons, and something was different about them. They weren't our benign staphs anymore. They made biofilm. Biofilm, if you think about it, is an igloo. It's a polysaccharide matrix that hosts organisms within it. It protects these organisms from the outside world. Within the biofilm, these normal planktonic one-celled bacteria that did everything by themselves now differentiate, and they share resistance factors. So when you start finding multiply antibiotic-resistant organisms, be thinking biofilm formers. And you'll be right. And I'm just going to tell you that if you are looking at response to antibiotics as one of your criteria for antibiotic benefit, and you have not done a deep aerobic API staph culture, I'm going to call you on it, because they are there in MSH patients. They are not there in MSH normal patients. I told you about von Willebrand's factor. Two-thirds of those patients are going to have abnormalities. They're high, they clot too much, or low, they bleed. Autoimmunity, Now when you get your false positive ANA in somebody and you say, well, it's a false positive, just get a TGF beta 1 because you'll find that that is the reason you've got an ANA that's positive when they don't have lupus or autoimmune events. This CRS is systemic. It's interacting. And, you know, you can't just draw one lab. And, you know, if you only had one thing to do, I would do visual contrast. I used to say HLA. Now I think I'm going to look at Treg cells if I had to do a blood test. You know, but you can't do that. You know, it's like saying I want one leg or one arm of my baby, and that'll be my child. You know, Solomon can cut the kid in half and get away with it, but I can't. Actually, he didn't cut the kid in half. It's Old Testament, right? Anyway, you're going to find that just about all of these illnesses that are called chronic fatigue have the same final common pathway. They all are chronic inflammatory response syndromes. And so when you start treating and you don't look at the inflammatory basis for the illness, you are not looking at what's wrong with your patients as a key thing. But above all, you are in charge. Differential diagnosis is the critical element. And if you don't think it's a moldy environment, at least have the courtesy to ask, do you have water intrusion in your home? Do you have a crawl space that's moist? Do you have this, that, or the other? Start looking for where water can get in. Now, what's been interesting to me is this concept of dreaded genotypes. There are some people have a 4-3-53, and that's just the jargon for how we break out DRB1, DQ, and DRB4. It comes with the test. And these guys have got everything wrong with them. The 11-3-52Bs, it's more common in women than men, but I probably can ask some women to stand up. I'm not going to do that, but ask women to stand up and let me see how long their fingers are and whether they can reach behind their head and clasp their hands behind their back, or they can lean forward and touch their clasped fingers to the floor and then step one foot through and then the other foot through. These hypermobile types, they're all 11-3-52B, just about. That's less than 1% of the control population. The 4-3-53s are less than 3% of control populations, and they're about 50% of your chronic fatiguers. It is a gigantic increased risk. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about this slide this afternoon, and if you see what I'm talking about, you've got the volleyball setter, and this is University of Nebraska women's volleyball team. Anybody be able to move your legs like that? And how about the fingers on this girl? Oh, I said, man, look at that. And you see somebody palming a basketball? Well, I don't have my fingers anyhow, but you know, it's important to recognize that when you have these hypermobile, flexible jointed people, how do they get that way? Where's that come from? Well, thankfully to Hal Dietz in 1991 and ever since, he's published on deficiency of 13 different kinds of fibrillin 1. Fibrillin 1 cross-links collagen. Fibrillin 1, when it's active, binds TGF-beta 1. Fibrillin 1, when it's mutated and not there, like in Marfan syndrome and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. You all know what Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is, right? The India rubber man, one finger and another, they're contortionists to do all these things, fold themselves, put themselves in a box. You know, where's the joints? And yet, she has got an arm and a half, doesn't she? And we all know about Michael Phelps. I think his athletic competition was helped by his hypermobility. And last night, just for fun, I measured on a card how long his long finger was. It comes down to beyond the proximal palmar crease. You got two of them, the distal and the proximal. When you get beyond the distal, that's one thing I look at. Your risk for 11-3-52B is increased, and beyond the proximal, you're almost guaranteed. If Michael Phelps gets sick from moldy building, not from swimming, not from a gym necessarily, or a locker room, Michael Phelps is going to have trouble. How about this guy? Can you look at his thumbs? You know, this is a person that can fold his thumbs back all the way like this. And here he is at a young man with arms that you can pick out. You know full well he's got a TGF-beta 1 problem if he gets exposed to mold. You can just look at them. Whoops. Well, this afternoon I got a couple more to follow that up. But just body habitus will give you a clue. And you don't have to be tall to have hypermobility. You know, the gymnasts that can do splits and all these things like that, just ask them. Just look at them. And you'd be surprised, people with small hands, they still, when their fingers come all the way down, you know, you can show off a little bit and say, well, I think you have 11.352B. You know, you're betting on 100-to-1 shot. That's not very good at a racetrack, but you kind of have the edge knowing the body habitus. All right, there are critical, important elements looking at relative risk. I told you about the linkages for mold. Here's over 5,000 patients, nearly 6,000 patients, looking at pediatric and adult in cases and controls. I mean, this really does hold. HLA-DRB1 is a bad guy all the way around, not just for biotoxin illnesses, but your worst cases of rheumatoid arthritis. And I heard people talking about rheumatoid arthritis, and I just hope that if you can talk about RA, whether they are making the cyclic citrullinated peptide or not, CCP, that's under the influence of 0401. If you're worrying about Lyme disease, remember there's about 30 different epitopes that have been identified by Alan Steer's group that 0401 will not process normally, that leads to persistent inflammation in those people. The worst malaria, the worst autoimmune hepatitis. The Lyme vaccine, some of you may remember about 10 years ago, basically it was an experiment in nature where we gave OspA to people and said, all right, here's an agonist for Toll-2 and Toll-4 receptors. Which one of you will develop a chronic inflammatory response syndrome? Well, guess what? It was 4353. Now, the litigation focused on the serologic type. They called it HLA-D4, and it never went anywhere because it didn't have the whole haplotype. But it's incredible. When you look at defective antigen presentation, how can you rely on antibody formation? Then you're going to use an antibody test to give you information? I mean, that's crazy. Look at the physiology. If you're going to look at antibodies, at least look at the physiology, too. They go hand in hand. This is an old model of the biotoxin pathway. There's a new one. Basically, the idea is that following environmental exposure to biotoxins, according to genetic susceptibility, there will be an inflammatory response that generates cytokine activity that knocks out normal production of MSH together with its other regulatory peptides in the hypothalamus, VIP, and then vasopressin. Now, vasopressin is also made in the posterior pituitary. It has critical roles in the suprachiasmatic nucleus with VIP to regulate MSH, which is in the infrachiasmatic nucleus, the medial nucleus of the hypothalamus. MSH deficiency will give you absence of normal production of melatonin in the brain, chronic non-restorative, non-restful sleep. MSH deficiency, MSH is made with beta-endorphin from its parent molecule, pro-opiomelanocortin. So if you've got MSH deficiency, guess what? Your perception of pain is abnormal. MSH deficiency is one accompanied by binding of cytokines to the leptin receptor in the hypothalamus. That's the long isoform of leptin. And if you can't get leptin to turn on MSH production, you're going to have rising leptin. People start gaining weight, and here you are. So here's an illness that in so many people makes them fat. There are a few low leptins that are the variants of this thing. Most people with chronic fatigue will have chronic pain. Nice illness. Look for MSH deficiency. MSH deficiency will give you increased permeability in gut. I have always argued with the leaky gut folks who didn't control for MSH. They're the one paper from Lipton and Catania looking at MSH binding sites in the gut. It's just phenomenal. And when you fix MSH, leaky gut goes away. Interestingly, the MSH deficient patients are the ones that have coag neg staphs, the multiply antibiotic resistant one growing in deep aerobic nasal spaces. This is one of the beauties of MSH replacement that's thought to be coming down the pike, is that we will knock out staphs, even the bad guys, the staph aureus, the multiply antibiotic resistant, and we'll also knock out candida. What a great compound. And the FDA is still looking at that. MSH also exerts huge effects on ACTH and cortisol. I scream bloody murder when patients are giving steroids in any form, prednisone, hydrocortisone, Cortef, you name it, without recognition of the possibility of suppressing ACTH. If you lose AMSH and VIP and vasopressin regulation of inflammation and they're living on ACTH, please don't give them Cortef. You will knock out their last anti-inflammatory pathway. Same thing with androgens, and then you will find the spectacularly common finding of increased thirst, frequent urination, and increased susceptibility to static shocks in MSH-deficient patients. Oops, going backwards. I've been living this life since 1997. You need to know that biotoxins are made by biological creatures. I first thought they were all neurotoxins. They're not. They are very small molecules that bind to receptors. They set off inflammation. The injury is not from the toxin itself necessarily, although that is true in some like Ciguatera. The injury comes from initiation of inflammation. I put this slide up, and I'll show you this afternoon again, to show the difference between some biotoxins. Botulinum is made by a living creature, right? Clostridia botulinum. But look how big that compound is. That is not an ionophore, and that compound won't move from cell to cell. But if you come down the list and you start looking at the dinoflagellate toxins and some of these frog toxins and seashells and pufferfish and all this, blue-green algae, and then some mycotoxins, they're all basically less than 4,000 Daltons in size. These are small molecules. I talked to you a little bit about androgen presentation and how that can be disrupted. Fungal toxins called trichothekenes knock out some of these cell determinants necessary for processing toxins on the membrane. Polycyclic ethers stop acidification. Bordetella has its own role. There are intracellular organisms that will prevent proper antigen recognition of the phagoendolysosome, and the list goes on. It is spectacularly fascinating to look to see that anthrax has intracellular effects on lysosomes, and we know that in this situation where T regulatory cells are disrupted, that we are going to have additional problems in this whole idea. By the way, if you don't have antigen presented properly to make an antibody, you going to make one? Nope. And if you don't make an antibody, you're going to clear the antigen? They're ionophores. They go from cell to cell. They don't stay much in blood. You can get rid of them? Nope. They get dumped into liver along cells that line bile ducts. These bile canalicular cells have special mechanisms. The organic anion transport protein system will secrete these biotoxins against a gradient and dump them into bile. It's worse if you don't have androgens. It's worse if you've got a problem with glutathione. Oh, I said that word, my pet peeve, glutathione. But specifically, what you'll have is now these compounds dumped into bile, they go through the sphincter of Oddi and the duodenum, and they get reabsorbed. If they get reabsorbed, they go around the body again. They set off their receptors again. And the damage goes on. I give you cholestyramine or Welchol, these great big quaternary ammonium compounds. You take on an empty stomach, you wash through the stomach four times a day into duodenum, and their net positive charge curiously binds the net negative charge of these biotoxins. Whoa, guess why I use cholestyramine? It binds and prevents enterohepatic recirculation. Because the key thing is that if you don't get rid of the inflammagen and the toxin, the illness goes on whether you're in a moldy building or not. Whether you are still eating grouper or snapper, not any of the fish we had last night. All fresh ones around here, not from a reef. But reef fish are problems. Antigen detection, we've talked about it. As soon as you identify a foreign invader, what happens is gene activation and release of inflammatory cells. Normally, regulatory neuropeptides take care of this antigen detection release of cytokines. But once there is binding to leptin receptor and you knock out MSH, Once you knock out VIP in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, where it regulates stimuli from olfactory neurons especially, you start getting chemical sensitivity and smell sensitivity developing. It doesn't happen right away. But in this whole situation, we have now the insane asylum being run by the inmates. We've got the chicken running around without his head. No command and control. Remember, that's what we heard when the U.S. invaded Iraq. Knock out command and control. And that's what we did. We're still there, I think. And look what happens to the chronic fatigue patients. They stay sick. They don't self-heal. I wonder why that is. You don't have to say diagnosis of exclusion. Here's why I could quibble with the Fukuda definition of chronic fatigue and all these others. You know, they say kind of glibly, well, we ruled everything else out. You did? What did you rule in? Show me a diagnostic blood test for fibromyalgia, please. You got one? Start looking at those with putative chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia for these 6, 7, 8 parameters. They'll jump off the page. This is part of a chronic inflammatory response syndrome. And if you think for a minute that the host from yesterday is not affected by exposure today, I got news for you. You're thinking it's wrong. Exposure today and tomorrow affect the host. It doesn't matter whether you got 4 arms and 3 legs. Exposure affects you. Look for environmental exposures. Get a baseline of labs so you know where you are. So many people call up and say, well, Richie, we can't draw that much blood. You know, that's too much. Which ones of these should I get? Don't forget the biofilm formers. That is the second element in this whole protocol. They've got to be eradicated. Treat the inflammatory physiology that you identify. And basically, I hate to say this, you're almost doing veterinary medicine. Because symptoms are about the last thing that you can rely on when people have cognitive injury, when they're tired. They might have a good day, and they might be tired of saying they feel tired. They might be sick of saying they feel sick. So when you deal with human emotions of denial, what have you, it creates some problems. So I just say focus on the inflammatory parameters. Now, having said all that, the skill of you guys as caring physicians is way more than what the internist has who has 10 minutes to see the patient. Because when you say, you know, are you tired, you look for non-restorative, non-restful sleep. Look for push-crash of, you know, I had a good day, I tried to do more, and I felt wiped out for 2 days. You'll be figuring things out, recognizing that immunology gives you the targets to shoot at. Now, visual contrast is old time. There's all kinds of variations we can see. You can measure capillary perfusion and retina with sophisticated lasers, but basically this bedside diagnostic test that's been around and calibrated for years will be of great benefit to you. Like genomics testing, visual contrast is simple, it's easy, it's reliable. If you look at a biotoxin illness, pretty much by day 4, visual contrast is locked in. It changes very little from day to day. And what we're looking at with visual contrast is this group of neurons that are parvocellular for low frequency and magnocellular fibers for high frequency. What we're really looking at is there a neurologic deficit from capillary hypoperfusion? And we control for near vision and far and static and color and motion and peripheral motion. We control those vision fibers. We only look at contrast. And if you're seeing, there's a little too much light in this room, but if you look at this slide, I think Neil showed it too, normal visual testing for eye test, a Snellen chart, is way up here at about 24 cycles per degree of visual arc. We divide these into 3, 6, 12, and 18 degrees per cycle of visual arc. And we kind of say, can you see these sinusoidal wave patterns against a gray background? And as fascinating as you lose neuron function, you can't. You've got to have near vision with glasses, if they wear glasses, of better than 20/50. Your light has got to be better than 70 foot Lamberts. Just 2 daylight fluorescent bulbs will do it. An incandescent light bulb behind your head won't. That's not good enough. But what you can start looking at And I'm just going to show you a few of these slides. We've got hundreds of these. Here's our control values. Here are a variety of different cases. We ask the question, are the people with the money spent on fungal ID better off or worse off than those with visible mold or those with musty smells? Interestingly, the worst curve were those with musty smells, because presumably they did less about it. In this repetitive exposure protocol, the people at baseline have suppression greatest in all rows, but especially suppression of C relative to B. And then when they're treated, they go up. When they stay away from exposure, they go up. When they're re-exposed, they go back down. When they're retreated, and then we keep on prophylactic medication, we restore the normal shape and the normal strength of the curve. So it doesn't really matter whether this is from a workplace or a home. It's just, you know, another study looking at the same kind of thing, is that visual contrast jumps off the page at you. And 92% of your patients who are sick will show a typical visual contrast deficit. Okay. Here's a lady comes in, and she's been sick for 4 years. She's got delayed recovery from normal activity. She's wiped out, brain doesn't work, her joints hurt. And when you do your differential diagnosis, you're not sure. And she says, you know, I applied for disability, I can't work. They told me I had somatoform illness. The rheumatologist got her out of the office quickly and said she had fibromyalgia. The people that love XMRV found that to be positive. And then the Lyme guy said you had Lyme disease. And I said, well, why don't we look at her innate immune response system, see what we got. See if she's got lack of regulation of innate immune responses. And she did have visual contrast testing. Does she have problems with the labs? Well, what a surprise. MSH and VIP are low. C4A, TGF-beta-1, MMP9 are sky high. VEGF is dead low. She's dehydrated. She's got cardiolipin antibodies. She's been treated for Lyme. She's got a ton of antibiotic resistance. She's got VCS deficits that XMRV does not give you. And guess what? She's got HLA susceptibility. What a surprise. In this case, she was just a mold patient, so to speak, but she had reduced VO2 max that we could measure on her pulmonary stress test. Her VO2 max was 14 milliliters per kilogram per minute. That will give you a class 3 cardiac disability when you apply for Social Security disability income. And where all this pushcraft comes from is lack of oxygen delivery in exercise reduces mitochondrial function. It's not mitochondrial disease. You know what I'm talking about. We're looking at a limited amount of glycogen that's in a cell that gets chewed up with about a 5% efficiency when mitochondria drop out. And so what we've got in this person is they get a breakdown of sugar from glycogen into lactate and pyruvate and two ATPs, but lactate rises because it's not metabolized with pyruvate by the mitochondria. So you chew up glucose, glycogen's gone, you're leptin resistant, so you won't mobilize fat stores, you can't get direct beta oxidation of fatty acids, so what do? You burn protein. Alanine, glutamine very quickly converted to sugar. So now the guy says, I want to do a little bit, I finally feel good for the first time in a week, and I'm going to do a little bit extra. And they burn protein. They went to the internist and he says, you need to exercise more and eat less. Ay, ay, ay. These protein wasting people now spend 2 days, because that's how long it takes, to replenish intracellular glycogen. And you say, why do I have push crash? Why do I feel so bad? How about the brain? Let's look at glutamate excitation versus glutamine, which is inhibition, as a function of lactate delivery in the brain. We can look at four areas on MR spectroscopy looking for capillary hypoperfusion. Remember I told you we can measure it in VO2 max as well as with MR spectroscopy. High lactate is associated with problems with reduced ratios of glutamate to glutamine. And MR spectroscopy is quick and easy. The lab might give you a hard time doing that. But be looking for water damage buildings. be very careful when you diagnose post-Lyme. I'm going to disagree with those that are liberal with use of antibody testing. Antibodies, in my mind, are yes or no. You got them or not. And I know other people argue with me, and that's fine. Ask about reef fish. Ask about cyanobacteria. You know, Klamath Lake used to be one of the main sources of people using source of blue-green algae for health foods until they had a huge outbreak of microcystis in Klamath Lake. You know, stop eating blue-green algae if you don't know the source, because microcystis will give you a biotoxin illness. I don't think you have recluse spider bites here. We have Mediterranean recluse spider bites, and just like with the Beruli ulcer problem from a Mycobacteria invadens worldwide, the reservoir for those toxins is in skin. And so when you see people with their skin painted with yellow cholestyramine, and then you know they've been to see me and I'm depleting their skin reservoirs, but they also get actus and cholestyramine. The symptoms are many, and we're running out of time, so I'm aware of that. If you look at clusters of symptoms and you find six of these clusters, they are found in no other illnesses I've found to date other than biotoxin illnesses. So go ahead and do cluster analysis. And just remember that executive cognitive dysfunction is telling you about lack of oxygen delivery, elevated lactate, and reduced levels of glutamate compared to glutamine. So recent memory problems, decreased concentration, word finding, decreased assimilation of new knowledge, confusion, disorientation. Don't do a $5,000 neurocog exam. Do a visual contrast test and take a history. You will find countless patients who have these kinds of problems. Prospective exposures tell the tale. The genomics testing is absolutely spectacular, and hopefully 2 months from now I'll be talking to you about how to sort out genomics fingerprinting that we now have for post-Lyme syndrome, for water damage building illness in its different stage of treatment, and from Ciguatera. Here's what some of those look like for Ciguatera, and we pick out about 500 genes, and red is suppressed and green is activated. These are looking at cases controls with Ciguatera, just to give you an idea that the genomics testing includes compounds you have never heard of. Well, certainly I've never heard of. We know that pattern recognition is critical in cytokine responses that dominate these illnesses. TGF-beta 1 is a giant in this player, transforming growth factor. You change cell types. We know that TGF-beta 1 drives particular lymphocytes to become Th17 cells. They release interleukin-17. TGF-beta 1 affects T regulatory cells. It sets off differential gene activation. TGF-beta 1 is a giant in this field. In this whole issue, we have a dynamic process. The dynamic process are these interactions of inflammatory elements and people going in and out of exposures. We can use statistical methods to look at cluster analysis together with labs and do these positive least squares analysis of mold and control patients. Blue is control and red are cases. And you really can develop all the scatter diagrams you want. If someone says, can you show sensitivity and specificity? Well, yeah, here is your little setup on logistic regression. And we basically get a 98.5% likelihood of identification of a case just with symptoms and visual contrast. That's all we need. And we've done that with another group of people. You know, people don't tell you what's wrong with them when they're sick. You know, they look pretty good, and they'll tell you, well, doctor, the intern has said, I look way too good to have this many illnesses. Well, don't be deceived. Do your review of systems. I told you about MR spectroscopy, and specifically, if you can order MRIs, ask your MRI facility to do spectroscopy for you. We look at white matter markers of N-acetyl-aspartate, cell markers of creatine, neurotransmitters of acetylcholine, and glial cell markers or myo-inositol, and we're looking for high lactate and suppression of glutamate to glutamine. You'll find that present in 0.9% of controls and correction, 0.9 out of 8 abnormalities and controls and 5.2 in cases. The key issue is that when someone comes up with a psychiatric diagnosis and they've not looked at inflammation, I say, wait a minute, is that how you're trained to treat dementia? Is that how you're trained to treat delirium? You look for underlying metabolic disorders, don't you? And why are you assuming it's depression or stress when you haven't looked for MSH and C4A? This is just an idea, it's a marker for what you see. You'll look at a 1 cubic centimeter area. Here is a right frontal lobe. We also use left frontal lobe and hippocampi, but then you get the magnetic spectrum. Here's N-acetyl aspartate as well as some others, and the radiologist can give you those measurements. Hippocampus is in the base of the brain. We can correlate spectroscopy findings with ERMI. To me, this was just spectacular, looking at those with cognitive issues, and the worse ERMI, the higher number of abnormalities in MR spectroscopy. I've told you about Marcon's living in biofilms. We've done cultures that are API staff, very special cultures. Biofilms must be opened and they grow very slowly. Specifically, these commensals have reservoirs and dogs' noses and wet buildings, and they will reinfect those with MSH. I love this slide. We can look at profuseness of biofilm formation and correlate that with refractoriness of the treatment for coagnac staphs and chronic fatigue. We use rifampin to penetrate the biofilm orally. We use a combination of EDTA, gentamicin, and mucoprosin for a month in a nose spray, and these organisms will tell you. C4A is made by activation of the alternative pathway of complement, and I feel like what I'm doing now is what Sid calls Niagara Falls, trying to run too far, too fast. When you activate the MASP2 enzyme that auto-activates, it will split C4 into C4A and C4B. If you have a bacterial membrane present, and this is important for the Lyme community, you will have C4A present, but its buddies, C4B and C2A, also released by MASP2, create a factor that splits C3A. So with a bacterial membrane, you get C4A and C3A. So if you think Lyme, look for C3A to separate that from mold. I'm going to skip past these. I've told you a little bit about C4A. It must be done by RIA. Cambridge Biomedical does not do the right assay anymore. Make sure LabCorp does their new assay using Futhan correctly. We're validating their assay right now. C4A is incredible in creating cognitive issues and is associated with profound cognitive deficits. I'm going to close right now. There are some slides on VIP that I'm going to cover in this afternoon's talk, and I'm sorry I've run out of time, but this is a very complex field. So thank you for your attention.